religious fanatic. Since she had been last at Uther's court, the fortified wall had risen higher, and there were sentries on the wall who called out to challenge her party. She had instructed her men to use none of her titles, but to say only that the queen's sister had come. It wasn't the time to demand that they give respect to her as the Lady of Avalon. Her present mission was too urgent for that. They were led through the grass-grown enclosure, past all the clutter of an enclosed fort. She could hear somewhere the sound of an armourer or blacksmith beating on his anvil. Some herdswomen, clad roughly in skin tunics, were driving sheep inside for the night. Vivian, recognising all these preparations for a siege, raised her eyelids slightly. A scant few years before, Igraine had run to meet her in the courtyard at Tintagel. Now a solemn chamberlain, richly clad, and having but one arm, no doubt a veteran of Uther's service, welcomed her with a solemn bow and conducted her to an upper chamber.
"I'm sorry, lady," he said. "We are short of living space here. You must share this room with two of the Queen's ladies."
"I shall be honoured," she said gravely.
"I will send you a serving woman. You have only to ask her for anything you require."
"All I require," said Vivian, "is a little water for washing, and to know when I can see my sister."
"Lady, I'm certain the Queen will receive you at the proper time."
"Does Uther keep state like the Caesars, then?"
"Listen to me, fellow. I am the Lady of Avalon, and I am not accustomed to be kept waiting. But if Igraine has grown to such high state as all this, and I beg you to send the Lady Morgaine to me as quickly as is possible."
The one-armed veteran shrank back, but when he spoke his voice was less formal and more human.
"Lady, I'm sure the Queen would receive you willingly at once, but you have come at a time of trouble and danger. The young Prince Gwydion fell this morning from a horse no one should have let him ride, and the Queen won't leave his side, not for an instant."
"By the goddess, I came too late then," Vivian whispered to herself.
Aloud, she said, "Take me to them at once. I'm skilled in all the healing arts, and I'm sure Igraine would have sent for me if she knew I were here." He bowed and said, "Come this way, lady."
Following him, Vivian realized that she hadn't even had time to remove her cloak or the men's breeches she wore for riding, and she had meant to present herself in all the dignity of Avalon. Well, this was more important. Outside the door, the chamberlain paused.
"It would be as much as my head's worth to disturb the Queen. She won't even let her ladies bring her food or drink."
Vivian pushed the heavy door and went into the room. Dead silence. It was uncannily like a death chamber. Igraine, pale and wan, her headcloth rumpled, knelt like a stone figure beside the bed. A black-robed priest stood motionless, muttering prayers under his breath. Softly as she moved, Igraine heard her. "How dare you?" she began in a furious whisper, and broke off. "Vivian, God must have sent you to me."
"I had a warning that you might need me," said Vivian. This was no time to speak of magical visions. "No, Igraine, you can do no good by weeping," she added. "Let me look at him and see how serious this is."
"The king's physician
is probably an old fool who knows nothing but potions of goat's dung," said Vivian calmly. "I was healing wounds of this kind before you were out of swaddlings, Igraine. Let me see the child."
She had seen Uther's son only once, briefly. He had been about 3 years old, and looked like any other fair-haired, blue-eyed toddler. Now he had stretched out to unusual tallness for his age. Thin but well-muscled arms and legs, much scratched by briars and brambles like any active boy's. She put aside the covers and saw the great livid bruises on his body.
Did he cough any blood at all?
Not even a little. The blood on his mouth was where a tooth was knocked out, but it was loose anyway. And indeed, Vivian could see the contused lip and the extra gap in his mouth. More serious was the bruise on the temple, and Vivian knew a moment of real fear. Had all their planning come to this? She ran her small fingers across his head. She could see him flinch when she touched the bruise, and that was the best sign she could possibly have had. If he had been bleeding inside the skull, he would by this time have been so deep in coma that no possible pain could reach him. She reached down and pinched his thigh very hard, and he whimpered in his sleep. Igraine protested.
"You're hurting him."
"No," Vivian said. "I'm trying to find out if he will live or die. Believe me, he will live."
She slapped his cheek gently, and he opened his eyes for a moment. "Bring me a candle," Vivian said, and moved it slowly across his field of vision. He followed it for a moment before his eyes fell shut again with a whimper of pain. Vivian rose from his side.
"Make sure he's kept quiet and nothing but water or soup. Nothing solid to eat for a day or two. And don't sop his bread in wine, only in soup or milk. He'll be running all over the place in 3 days." "How do you know?" demanded the priest.
"Because I am trained in healing. How do you think?"
"Are you not a sorceress from the Island of Witches?"
Vivian laughed softly. "By no means, Father. I am a woman who, like yourself, has spent her life in the study of holy things, and God has seen fit to give me skill at healing. She could, she reflected, turn their own jargon against them. She knew, if he did not, that the God they both worshipped was greater and less bigoted than any priesthood. Igraine, I must talk to you. Come away."
"I must be here when he wakes again. He will want me."
"Nonsense. Send his nurse to him. This is a matter of importance."
Igraine glared at her. "Bring Isotta to sit beside him," she said to one of the women with an angry look, and followed Vivian into the hall.
"Igraine, how did this happen?"
"I'm not sure. Some tale about riding his father's stallion. I'm confused. I only know that they carried him in like one dead."
"And it was only your good fortune that he wasn't dead," Vivian said bluntly. "Is it thus that Uther safeguards the life of his only son?"
"Vivian, don't reproach me. I have tried to give him others," Igraine said, and her voice shook. "But I think I am being punished for my adultery, that I can give Uther no other son."
"Are you mad, Igraine?"
Vivian burst out, and then stopped herself. It was not fair to upbraid her sister when she was distracted from watching at the bedside of her sick child. "I came because I foresaw some danger to you or the child, but we can talk of that later. Call your women. Put on fresh clothing. And when did you last eat anything?" she asked shrewdly.
"I can't remember. I think I had a little bread and wine last night."
"Then call your women and break your fast," Vivian said impatiently. "I'm still dusty from riding. Let me go and wash off the dirt of travel, and clothe myself as is seemly for a lady inside the walls, and then we will talk."
"Are you angry with me, Vivian?"
Vivian patted her on the shoulder.
"I am angry, if it is anger, only at the way fate seems to fall, and that is foolish of me. Go and dress, Igraine, and eat something. The child's come to no harm this time."
Inside her room a fire had been built, and on a small stool before it she saw an undersized female, dressed in a robe so dark and plain that for a moment Vivian thought it was one of the serving wenches. Then she saw that the simple gown was of the finest stuff, the headcloth embroidered linen, and she recognised Igraine's daughter.
"Morgaine," she said, and kissed her.
The girl was almost as tall now as Vivian herself.
"Why, I think of you as a child, but you are almost a woman."
"I heard you had come, Aunt, and came to welcome you. But they told me you had gone at once to my brother's bedside." "How does he, lady?"
"He's badly bruised and banged about, but he'll be well again with no treatment but rest," Vivian said. "When he wakes, I must somehow convince Igraine and Uther to keep the physicians and their stupid potions away from him. If they make him vomit, he'll be worse. I got nothing from your mother but weeping and wailing. Can you tell me how this came to happen? Is there no one here who can guard a child properly?"
Morgaine twisted her small fingers together. "I'm not sure how it happened. My brother's a brave child, and always wants to ride horses which are too fast and too strong for him. But Uther has given orders that he's only to ride with a groom. His pony was lame that day, and he asked for another horse. But how he came to take out Uther's stallion, no one knows. All the grooms know that he's never allowed to go near Thunder, and everyone denied seeing him. Uther swore he'd hang the groom who allowed it. But that groom has put the river between Uther and himself by now, I should imagine. Still, they say Gwydion's stuck on Thunder's back like a sheep in a thorn thicket, until someone loosed a breeding mare in the stallion's path. And we cannot find out who loosed the mare, either. So, of course, the stallion was off after the mare, and my brother was off the stallion in the blink of an eyelash." Her face, small and dark and plain, quivered. "He's really going to live?"
"He's really going to live."
"Has anyone yet sent word to Uther? Mother and the priest said he could do no good in the sick room."
"No doubt Igraine will attend to that."
"No doubt,"
Morgaine said, and Vivian surprised a cynical smile on her face. Morgaine evidently bore no love to Uther, and thought no more of her mother for her love to her husband. Yet she had been conscientious enough to remember that Uther should be sent word about his son's life. This was no ordinary young girl.
"How old are you now, Morgaine? The years go by so fast I no longer remember as I grow old."
"I shall be 11 at Midsummer."
"Old enough," Vivian thought, "to be trained as a priestess." She looked down and realised she was still wearing her travel-stained clothing.
"Morgaine, will you have the serving women bring me some water for washing, and send someone to help me robe myself properly to appear before the king and queen?"
"Water I have sent for. It's there in the cauldron by the fire," Morgaine said, and then hesitated and added shyly, "I would be honoured to attend on you myself, lady."
"If you wish."
Vivian let Morgaine help her remove her outer garments and wash off the dust of travel. Her saddlebags had been sent up too, and she put on a green gown. Morgaine touched the cloth with admiring fingers.
"This is a fine green dye. Our women can make no green as fine as this. Tell me, what do you use to make it?"
"Woad, no more."
"I thought that made only blue dyes."
"No, this is prepared differently, boiled and fixed. I will talk of dyes with you later if you are interested in herb lore," Vivian said. "Now we have other matters on our mind. Tell me, is your brother given to escapades like this?"
"Not really. He's strong and hardy, but he's usually biddable enough," Morgaine said. "Once someone taunted him about riding so small a pony, and he said that he was to be a warrior, and a soldier's first duty is to obey orders, and that his father had forbidden him to ride a horse beyond his strength. So I can't imagine how he came to ride Thunder. But still, he wouldn't have been hurt unless...
Vivian nodded. I would like to know who loosed that mare, and why. Morgaine's eyes widened as she took in the implications of this.
Watching her, Vivian said,
Think, has he had any other narrow escapes from death, Morgaine?
Morgaine said, hesitating, He had the summer fever, but then all the children had that last year. Uther said he shouldn't have been allowed to play with the shepherd's boys. He caught the fever from them, I think. Four of them died. But there was the time when he was poisoned.
Poisoned?
Isotta. And I would trust her with my life, lady. Swears that she put only wholesome herbs into his soup. Yet he was as sick as if a death-cap mushroom had found its way into his porridge. And yet... How could that be? She knows wholesome ones from the poisoners, and she's not yet old, and her eyesight is good.
Again Morgaine's eyes widened.
Lady Vivian, do you think there are people plotting against my brother's life?
Vivian drew the girl down to her side. I came here because I had a warning of this. I have not yet inquired whence the danger comes... I had no time. Do you have the sight still, Morgaine? When last I spoke with you, you said...
The girl coloured and looked down at her shoes. You bade me not speak of it. And Igraine says I should turn my thoughts to real things and not daydreams. And so I've tried.
Igraine is right thus far, that you should not speak idly of these things to the once-born, Vivian said. But to me, you may always speak freely, I promise you. My sight can show me only such things as are relevant to the safety of the Holy Isle and the continuance of Avalon. But Uther's son is your own mother's son, and by that tie your sight will find him and be able to tell who is trying to compass his death.
Uther has enemies enough, all the gods know.
But I don't know how to use the sight.
I will show you, if you wish it, said Vivian.
The girl looked up at her, her face taut with fear. Uther has forbidden sorceries in his court.
Uther is not my master, Vivian said slowly, and no one can rule over another's conscience. Yet... Do you think it is an offence to God to try to discover whether someone is plotting against your brother's life, or whether it is only bad luck?
Morgaine said unsteadily, No, I don't think it wicked.
She stopped and swallowed and finally said,
And I don't think you would lead me into anything that was wrong, Aunt.
A sudden pain clutched at Vivian's heart. What had she done to earn this trust? With all her heart she wished that this small, solemn girl was her own daughter. The daughter she owed the Holy Isle and had never been able to bear. Even though she had risked a belated childbearing, of which she had nearly died, she had borne only sons. And here, it seemed... was the successor the goddess had sent her, a kinswoman with the sight. And the girl was looking up at her with complete trust. For a moment she couldn't speak. Am I prepared to be ruthless with this girl too? Can I train her, never sparing? Or will my love make me less harsh than I must be to train a high priestess? Can I use her love for me? Which I have in no way deserved, to bring her to the feet of the goddess. But with the discipline of years, she waited until her voice was clear and perfectly steady. Be it so, then. Bring me a silver or bronze basin, perfectly clean and scoured with sand, and fill it with fresh rainwater, not water drawn from the well. Be sure that you speak to no man or woman after you have filled the basin." She waited, composed, seated by her fire, until at last Morgaine returned. "I had to scrub it myself," she said. But the basin she held out was shining and brilliant, filled to the brim with clear water. "Now, unbind your hair, Morgaine." The girl looked at her curiously, but Vivian said, low and stern, "No questions." Morgaine pulled out the bone hairpin, and her long locks, dark and coarse and perfectly straight, came tumbling down around her shoulders. "Now, if you are wearing any jewellery, take it off and set it over there so that it won't be near the basin." Morgaine tugged off two little gilt rings she had on her finger and unpinned the brooch from her overdress. Without the pin holding it, the overdress fell around her shoulders, and without comment, Vivian helped her pull it off, so that she stood in her undergown alone. Then Vivian opened a little bag she wore about her neck and took out a small quantity of crushed herbs, which wafted a sweetish, musty scent through the chamber. She sifted only a few grains into the basin of water before saying in a low, neutral voice, "Look into the water, Morgaine. Make your mind perfectly still, and tell me what you see." Morgaine came and knelt before the basin of water, looking intently into its clear surface. The room was very silent, so still that Vivian could hear the small chirping of some insect outside. Then Morgaine said in a wandering, unfocused voice, "I see a boat. It's draped with black, and there are four women in it. Four queens, for they wear crowns. And one of them is you. Or is it me?" "It is the barge of Avalon," Vivian said, low. "I know what you see." She passed her hand lightly over the water and saw the ripples follow her hand. "Look again, Morgaine. Tell me what you see." This time the silence was longer. Finally the girl said, in that same strange tone, "I see deer, a great herd of deer, and a man among them with his body painted. They put the antlers on him. Oh, he is down. They will kill him." Her voice trembled, and again Vivian passed her hand above the surface of the water, and the ripples passed over the surface. "Enough," she commanded. "Now see your brother." Silence. Again a silence that stretched and dragged. Vivian felt her body cramped with the tension of stillness, but she didn't move with the long discipline of her training. At last Morgaine murmured, "How still he lies. But he's breathing. Soon he will wake. I see my mother. No, it isn't mother. It is my aunt Morgaine, and all of her children are with her. There are four of them. How strange. They are all wearing crowns. There is another. He's holding a dagger. Why is he so young? Is he her son? Oh, he will kill him. He will kill him. Oh, no." Her voice rose to a shriek. Vivian touched her shoulder. "Enough," she said. "Wake, Morgaine." The girl shook her head like a puppy stretching after sleep. "Did I see anything?" she asked. Vivian nodded. "Some day you will learn to see and to remember," she said. "For now it is enough." Now she was armed to confront Uther and Igraine. Lot of Orkney was, as far as she knew, an honourable man, and had taken oath to support Uther. But should Uther die without an heir? Morgawse had borne 2 sons already, and there were likely to be more. Morgaine had seen 4, and there was no way in which the little kingdom of Orkney would support 4 princes. The brothers, when they grew to manhood, were likely to be at one another's throats. And Morgawse. Sighing, Vivian remembered Morgawse's vaulting ambition. If Uther died without an heir, then Lot, married to the queen's own sister, would be a logical choice for the throne. And the succession would be Lot as high king, Lot's sons heirs to the smaller kingdoms. Would Morgawse stoop to plot against the life of a child? Vivian didn't like to think that of the girl she had nursed at her own breasts. Put Morgawse and Lot together with their ambitions. Easy enough, perhaps, to bribe a groom or insinuate one of her own men into Uther's court, with orders to lead the child into danger as often as possible. Not so easy, of course, to get past a faithful nurse, who was his own mother's faithful waiting-woman. But she could be drugged, or given stronger drink than usual, to make her confused, so that something deadly found its way past her vigilance. And no matter how well a child rode, it would take more strength than any 6-year-old had to hold a stallion who scented a mare in season. All our plans could have come to ruin in a moment. At supper time, she found Uther alone at the high table, while the vassals and serving men ate their bread and bacon at a lower table in the hall. He rose and saluted her courteously. "Igraine is still at her son's side, sister-in-law. I begged her to go and sleep, but she said she would sleep after he wakened and knew her."
"I have already spoken with Igraine, Uther."
"Oh, yes. She told me. She said you have given your word that he would live." "Was that wise? If he dies after that..."
Uther's face was drawn and worried.
He looked no older than when he had married Igraine. His hair was so fair, Vivian thought, that no one could see whether it was greyed or not. He was richly dressed in the Roman fashion, and he was clean-shaven, too, like a Roman. He wore no crown, but around his upper arms he had 2 torques of pure gold and a rich gold collar. "He won't die this time. I have some experience with head wounds, and the injuries to the body haven't penetrated the lungs. He'll be running around in a day or 2. Uther's face relaxed somewhat.
"If I ever find out who loosed that mare, I should beat the boy senseless for riding thunder."
"There would be no point in that. He has already paid the price of his rashness, and I'm sure it will teach him whatever lesson is needed," Vivian said. "But you should set better guard on your son."
"I cannot guard him night and day."
Uther's face was haggard. "I'm away so often at the wars, and I cannot keep so big a boy tied to his nurse's apron. And we've come near to losing him before this."
"Morgaine told me."
"Bad luck. Bad luck. The man with only 1 son walks always at the mercy of any stroke of bad luck," said Uther. "But I am remiss in courtesy, kinswoman. Here, sit beside me. Share my dish, if you will. I know Igraine longed to send to you, and I gave her leave to send a messenger. But you have come more swiftly than any of us dreamed."
"Is it true, then, that the witches of the Holy Islands can fly?"
Vivian chuckled. "Would that I could! I wouldn't have spoiled 2 pair of good shoes in the mire. Alas, the folk of Avalon and the Merlin himself must walk or ride even as common folk."
She took a piece of the wheaten loaf and helped herself to butter from a small wooden cask.
"You who wear the serpents at your wrists should know better than to credit those old fables.
But there is a bond of blood between us. Igraine is my mother's daughter, and I know when she has need of me.
Uther set his lips tight.
I have had dreams and sorceries enough. I want no more of them in my life.
This, as it was intended to do, silenced Vivian. She allowed one of the serving men to help her to salted mutton, and spoke amiably about the fresh boiled herbs, the first of the year. When she had eaten sparingly, she set down her knife and said, "However I came here, Uther, it was by good fortune, and a sign to me that your child is guarded by the gods, for he is needed."
"I cannot bear much more of such fortune,"
Uther said, and his voice was taut.
"If you are a sorceress indeed, sister-in-law, I would beg you to give Igraine a charm against barrenness. I thought when we were wedded that she would give me many children, since she had already borne a daughter to old Gorlois. But we have only one, and already he is 6 years old."
"It is written in the stars that you shall have no other son."
But Vivian forbore to say this to the man before her. Instead, she said,
"I will speak with Igraine, and be sure whether it is not some sickness in her which keeps her from conceiving." "Oh, she conceives right enough, but she can carry the child no more than a moon or two. And the one she brought to birth bled to death when his navel string was cut,"
Uther said grimly.
"He was misshapen, so perhaps it was as well. But if you could give her some charm for a healthy child... I don't know whether I believe in such things, but I'm ready to grasp at any straw."
"I have no such charms," Vivian said, honestly pitying him. "I am not the great goddess to give or withhold children from you, and I would not if I could. I cannot meddle with what the fates have decreed."
"Does not your own priest say as much to you?" "Oh, aye. Father Columba speaks about submitting myself to the will of God. But the priest has not a kingdom to rule which will fall into chaos if I die without an heir,"
Uther said.
"I cannot believe that is what God wants."
"None of us knows what God wants," Vivian said.
"Not you, nor I,
nor even Father Columba. But it seems certain to me, and it needs neither magic nor sorcery to see it, that you must guard the life of this little one, since he must come to the throne."
Uther's mouth tightened.
"God avert that fate," he said. "I should grieve for Igraine's sake if her son died, and even for my own. He is a fine and promising child, but he cannot be heir to the High King of Britain. There is no man in all the length and breadth of this kingdom who doesn't know that he was begotten while Igraine was still wife to Gorlois, and he came to birth a whole moon sooner than he should have been born, to be my son. True, he was small and puny, and babes are cast forth from the womb before their proper time. But I cannot go around and tell all those in the kingdom who were counting on their fingers, can I? He will be Duke of Cornwall when he is grown. But I can't hope to make him High King after me. Even if he lives to grow up, which with his luck is unlikely."
"He looks enough like you," Vivian said. "Do you think everyone at court is blind?"
"But what of all those who have never come to court? No. I must get myself an heir on whose birth there can be no stain. Igraine must bear me a son."
"Well, God grant it be so," Vivian said. "But you cannot force your will on God either, nor allow Gwydion's life to be thrown away."
"Why not send him to fosterage at Tintagel?"
"That is so remote, and if you put him in charge of your most trusted vassal, sending him there would convince everyone that he was truly Cornwall's son, and you have no intention of making him High King. Perhaps then they wouldn't bother to plot against him."
Uther frowned.
His life wouldn't be safe till after Igraine had borne me another son, he said, even if I sent him as far as Rome, or to the country of the Goths.
And with the hazards of the road, that isn't practical, Vivian agreed. I have, then, another suggestion. Send him to me, to be fostered in Avalon.
None can come there except the faithful who serve the Holy Isle. My own youngest son is already 7, but soon he will be sent to King Ban in Less Britain, to be fostered, as suits a nobleman's son. Ban has other sons, so Galahad isn't his heir. But Ban acknowledges him, and has given him lands and estates, and will have him at court as a page, and a soldier when he is grown. At Avalon, your son will learn all that he needs to know about the history of his land, and his destiny, and the destiny of Britain. Uther, none of your enemies knows where Avalon lies, and no harm could come near him. It would keep him safe. But for practical reasons, it isn't possible. My son must be reared as a Christian. The church is powerful. They would never accept any king.
I thought you said he couldn't be king after you, Vivian said dryly.
Well, there's always the possibility, Uther said in despair. If Igraine should have no other son. If he's been fostered among the druids and their magic, the priests would call that evil.
Do I seem evil to you, Uther?
Or does the Merlin?
She looked straight into his eyes, and Uther let his gaze fall.
No, of course not.
Then why will you not entrust Igraine's son to his wisdom and mine, Uther?
Because I too distrust the magic of Avalon, said Uther at last.
With a nervous gesture, he touched the tattooed serpents around his arms.
I saw such things on yonder island as would make any good Christian turn pale. And by the time my son is grown, this isle will be all Christian. There will be no need for a king to deal in such things.
Vivian felt like raging.
Fool, was the Merlin and I who set you on that throne, not your Christian priests and bishops.
But there was no good to be gained in arguing with Uther. You must do as your own conscience bids you, Uther. But I beg you to send him somewhere for fostering, and let that place be secret. Give it out that you are sending him out to be brought up in obscurity, away from the flattery of a prince at court. That's common enough. And let people think he's going to Less Britain, where he has cousins at Ban's court. Then send him to one of your poorer vassals. One of Ambrosius's old courtiers, perhaps. Urians, Ectorius. Someone very obscure and very trustworthy.
Uther nodded slowly. It will be a wrench to Igraine to part with the child, he said. But a prince must be fostered as suits his future destiny, and schooled in military strength. I will not tell even you, sister-in-law, where he is to go.
Vivian smiled to herself, thinking, Do you really think you can keep it a secret from me, Uther, if I wish to know? But she was too diplomatic to say it aloud.
I have another boon to ask of you, brother-in-law, she said. Give me more gain to foster in Avalon.
Uther stared a moment, then shook his head.
Impossible.
What is impossible to a high king, Pendragon?
There are only two fates for Morgaine, said Uther. She must marry a man completely sworn to me, one I trust. Or if I can find no such strong ally to give her, she is for the nunnery and the Vale. She'll raise up no Cornwall party in this kingdom.
She doesn't seem pious enough for a good nun. Uther shrugged.
For the dower I can give her, any convent will be glad to take her.
And suddenly Vivian was angry.
She fixed Uther with her gaze and said, "And do you think you can keep this kingdom long without the goodwill of the tribes, Uther? They care nothing for your Christ or your religion. They look to Avalon, and when these..." She put out a finger and touched his tattooed wrists. He drew nervously away, but she went on, "When these were set on your arms, they swore to obey the Pendragon. If Avalon withdraws its support from you, as high as we set you, Uther, that low can we bring you."
"Fine words, lady. But can you do as you threatened?"
Uther retorted.
"Would you do that for a girl, and Cornwall's daughter at that?"
"Test me." Her gaze was unflinching. This time he didn't lower his eyes from her. He was angry enough to meet her stare equally, and she thought, "Goddess, had I been 10 years younger, how this man and I could have ruled." In all her life she had known but one or two men who were her equal in strength. But Uther was an antagonist worthy of her steel. And he would need to be, to keep this kingdom together until the predestined king should grow to manhood. Even for Morgaine, she couldn't endanger that. But she thought she could make him see reason. "Uther, listen to me. The girl has the sight. She was born to it. There's no way she can escape the unseen. It will follow her wherever she goes. And in playing about with such things, she'll come to be shunned for a witch and despised. Is that what you want for a princess at your court? Do you doubt Igraine's ability to rear her daughter as befits a Christian woman? At worst, she could do no harm behind convent walls."
"No," Vivian said,
so loudly that some of the folk in the lower hall raised their heads and stared round at her.
"Uther, the girl's priestess born. Put her behind convent walls, and she'll pine like a caged skua gull. Could you send Igraine's child to death or lifelong misery?"
"I truly believe, and I've spoken with the girl, that she'd kill herself there." She could see that argument had reached him, and quickly pressed her point. "She's born to it. Let her be properly trained to her gifts. Uther, is she so happy here, or such an ornament to your court, that you would be sorry to see her leave it?" Slowly he shook his head.
"I've tried to love her for Igraine's sake, but she's uncanny," he said. "Morgawls used to tease her and say she was one of the fairy folk, and if I didn't know her parentage, I'd well believe it."
Vivian's smile was taut.
"True. She is like me, and like our mother. She is not for the convent or the church bell."
"Yet how can I take both Igraine's children from her at once?" Uther demanded, despairing.
That struck Vivian as well with a pang of grief, almost of guilt. But she shook her head.
"Igraine, too, is priestess-born. She will abide her destiny as you, Uther, abide yours. And if you fear the anger of your house-priest," she added, striking shrewdly at a guess, and saw in his eyes that she had hit home,
"then tell no one where you have sent her.
Put it about, if you wish, that you have sent her for schooling in a nunnery. She is too wise and sober for the ways of the court, small flirtations and womanish gossip. And Igraine, if she knows her children are safe and happy, growing toward their own fates, will be content while she has you."
Uther bowed his head.
"So be it," he said. "The boy to be fostered with my trustiest and most obscure vassal. But how can I send him there unknown? Will the danger not follow him?"
"He can be sent by hidden ways and under a glamour, as you yourself came to Tintagel," Vivian said.
"You trust me not, but will you trust the Merlin?" "With my very life,"
Uther said. Let the Merlin take him. And Morgaine, then, to Avalon.
He leaned his head in his hands as if the burden he bore were too great for endurance.
You are wise, he said, then raised his head and stared at her with unflinching hatred. I wish you were a foolish woman I could despise, damn you.
If your priests are right, said Vivian calmly, I am already thoroughly damned,
and you may save your breath. Chapter 11 The sun was setting as they came to the lake. Vivian twisted on her pony to look at Morgaine, who rode a little behind her. The girl's face was drawn with weariness and hunger, but she hadn't complained. And Vivian, who had deliberately set a hard pace to try her stamina, was satisfied. The life of a priestess of Avalon wasn't an easy one, and she needed to know that Morgaine could endure fatigue and hardship. She slowed her pony now, and let Morgaine draw abreast of her.
There lies the lake, she said. In a little while we will be within walls, and there will be fire and food and drink.
I shall be glad of all three, Morgaine said.
Are you tired, Morgaine?
A little, the girl said diffidently. But I'm sorry to see this journey end. I like seeing new things, and I've never gone anywhere before.
They halted their horses at the water's edge, and Vivian tried to see the familiar shore as it would appear to a stranger, the dull greyed waters of the lake, the tall reeds edging the shore, silent, low-hanging clouds, and tufts of weed in the water. It was a silent scene, and Vivian could hear the girl's thoughts.
It's lonely here, and dark and dismal.
How do we get to Avalon? There's no bridge. Surely we don't have to swim the horses, Morgaine asked her. And Vivian, remembering how they had had to do just that at a ford swollen by spring rains, reassured her quickly.
No, I will call the boat.
She raised her two hands to cover her face, shut out unwanted sight and sound, and sent out the silent call. Within moments, over the greying surface of the lake, a low barge appeared. Draped at one end in black and silver, it glided so silently that it seemed to skim over the water like some waterfowl. There was no sound of oars, but as it came nearer, they could see the silent oarsmen wielding their paddles without the slightest splash or sound. They were dark little men, half naked, their skins tattooed with blue woad in magical patterns. And Vivian saw Morgaine's eyes widen at the sight, but she said nothing.
She accepts all this too calmly, Vivian thought. She is young enough, but she doesn't see the mystery of what we do. Somehow, I must make her aware of it.
The silent little men moored the boat, securing it with a curiously woven rope of plaited reed. Vivian signalled to the girl to dismount, and the horses were led on board. One of the tattooed men held out his hand to Morgaine to help her step on board. She half expected it to be insubstantial, a vision like the boat. But instead, his hand felt calloused, hard as horn. Last, Vivian took her place in the prow, and the barge moved out, slowly and silently, into the lake. Ahead of them rose the aisle and the Tor, with its tall tower to St. Michael. Over the silent water the sound of church bells rang a soft angelus. Morgaine, from habit, crossed herself, and one of the little men gave her so sharp a frown that she flinched and dropped her hand. As the boat skimmed over the water through the overgrown reeds, she could make out the walls of the church and the monastery. Vivian could sense the young girl's sudden fear. Were they going, after all, to the Isle of Priests, where convent walls would close about her forever?
Are we going to the island church, aunt?
We will not come to the church, Vivian replied tranquilly.
though it is true that an ordinary traveller, or you yourself, if you set out upon the lake alone, would never come to Avalon.
Wait and see,
and ask no questions. That is to be your lot while you are in training.
Rebuked, Morgaine fell silent. Her eyes were still dilated with fear. She said in a low voice,
"It is like the folk tale of the fairy barge, which sets sail from the islands to the land of youth."
Vivian paid no attention. She stood in the prow of the boat, breathing deeply, summoning her strength for the magical act she was about to perform. For a moment, she wondered if she still had the strength for it.
"I am old," she thought with momentary panic. "Yet I must live until Morgaine and her brother are grown. The peace of all this land depends on what I can do to safeguard them." She cut off the thought. Doubt was fatal. She reminded herself that she had done this almost every day of her adult life, and by now it was so natural to her that she could have done it in her sleep, or if she were dying. She stood still, rigid, locked into the tension of magic, then stretched out her arms, extending them full length, raising them high above her head, palms toward the sky. Then, with a swiftly exhaled breath, she brought them down, and with them fell the mists, so that the site of the church was wiped out, and the shores of the Isle of the Priests, and even the Tor. The boat glided through thick, impenetrable fog, dark as night around them, and in the darkness she could hear Morgaine breathing quickly like a small, scared animal. She began to speak, to reassure the girl that there was nothing to fear, then deliberately held her peace. Morgaine was now a priestess in training, and must learn to conquer fear as she conquered fatigue and hardship and hunger. The boat began to glide through the mists, swiftly and surely, for there were no other boats on this lake. The boat pulled through the thick, clinging damp. Vivian felt it on her hair and eyebrows, soaking through her woolen shawl. Morgaine was shivering with the sudden cold. Then, like a curtain being pulled back, the mist vanished, and before them lay a sunlit stretch of water and a green shore. The Tor was there, but Vivian heard the young girl in the boat catch her breath in shock and astonishment. Atop the Tor stood a circle of standing stones, brilliant in the sunlight. Toward it led the great processional way, winding upward in a spiral around the immense hill. At the foot of the Tor lay the buildings where the priests were housed, and on the slope she could see the sacred well and the silver flash of the mirror pool below. Along the shore were groves of apple trees, and beyond them great oaks, with the golden shoots of mistletoe clinging to their branches in mid-air. Morgaine whispered,
"It is beautiful,"
and Vivian could hear the awe in her voice.
"Lady, is it real?"
"It is more real than any place you have ever seen," Vivian told her, "and soon you will know it."
The barge moved toward the shore and scraped heavily on the sandy edge. The silent oarsman moored it with a rope and assisted the lady to step on shore. Then they led the horses to land, and Morgaine was left to step on shore by herself. She was never to forget that first sight of Avalon in the sunset. Green lawns sloped down to the edge of the reeds along the lake, and swans glided, silent as the barge, over the waters. Beneath the groves of oak and apple trees rose a low building of grey stone, and Morgaine could see white-robed forms pacing slowly along the colonnaded walk. From somewhere, very softly, she could hear the sound of a harp. The low, slanting light, could it be the same sun she knew, flooded the land with gold and silence, and she felt her throat tighten with tears. She thought, without knowing why, "I'm coming home." Even though all the years of her life had been spent at Tintagel, and at Caerleon, and she had never seen this fair country before. Vivian finished giving directions about the horses and turned to Morgaine again. She saw the look of wonder and awe on the girl's face and forbore to speak until Morgaine drew a shaking breath as if waking from sleep. Women, robed in dark-dyed dresses, with over-tunics of deerskin, some of them with a crescent moon tattooed in blue between their brows, came down the path toward them. Some were like Morgaine and Vivian herself, small and dark, of the Pictish people. But a few were tall and slender, with fair or reddish-brown hair, and there were two or three who bore the unmistakable stamp of Roman ancestry. They bent before Vivian in silent respect, and she raised her hand in a gesture of benediction. "This is my kinswoman," Vivian said. "Her name is Morgaine. She will be one of you. Take her." Then she looked at the young girl who stood shivering as the sun sank and darkness dropped grey, draining the fantastic colours from the landscape. The child was weary and frightened. There were enough trials and ordeals before her. She need not begin them at this moment. "Tomorrow," she said to Morgaine, "you will go to the House of Maidens. It will make no difference there that you are my kinswoman and a princess. You will have no name and no favours except what you can earn for yourself. But for tonight only, come with me. We've had little time to talk together on this journey." Morgaine felt her knees wobbling with a sudden relief. The women facing her, all strange and with their alien dress and blue markings on their brows, frightened her more than the whole court of Uther assembled. She saw Vivian make a little dismissing motion, and the priestesses, for so she supposed they were, turned and went away. Vivian held out her hand, and Morgaine took it, feeling the fingers reassuringly cool and solid. Once again Vivian was the kinswoman she knew, yet at the same time she was the awesome figure who had brought down the mists. Once again Morgaine felt the impulse to make the sign of the cross, and wondered if all this country would vanish away, as Father Columba said all demon work and sorceries must vanish at that sign. But she didn't cross herself. She knew suddenly that she would never do so again. That world lay behind her forever. At the edge of the apple grove, between two trees just coming into blossom, stood a little house of wattle and daub. Inside a fire was burning, and a young woman, like the others she had seen, in dark dress and deerskin tunic, welcomed them with a silent bow. "Do not speak to her," said Vivian. "She is at present under a vow of silence. She is a priestess in her fourth year, and her name is Raven." In silence, Raven stripped off Vivian's outer garments and her muddy and travel-worn shoes. At a sign from Vivian, she did the same for Morgaine. She brought them water for washing, and later food, barley bread and dried meat. For drink there was only cold water, but it was fresh and delicious, unlike any water Morgaine had ever tasted. "It is the water of the sacred well," Vivian said. "We drink nothing else here. It brings vision and clear sight. And the honey is from our own hives. Eat your meat and enjoy it, for you will taste no more for years. The priestesses eat no meat until they have finished their training."
"Why is that, lady?"
Morgaine couldn't say aunt or kinswoman. Standing between her and the familiar names was the memory of the goddess-like figure summoning the mists.
"Is it wrong to eat meat?"
"Surely not. And a day will come when you may eat whatever food comes to you. But a diet free of animal flesh produces a high level of consciousness, and this you must have while you are learning to use the sight and to control your magical powers rather than letting them control you.
Like the druids in the early years of their training, the priestesses eat only bread and fruit, and sometimes a little fish.